The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial for the final stream tonight, and I'm here with Semiogog. Now, Semiogog has appeared on Millennial every year since 2018, so this is his sixth appearance. Yeah, very good. So welcome back to Millennial, Semiogog.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. It is my pleasure. As always, I had a number of different possible things to talk about. One was being a mutt genetically. Another one was a defense of conspiratards. But in our pre-stream chat, we resolved upon the idea of talking about the year, which I do. You know, it feels like that's going to be more spontaneous, more natural. So yeah. Hot damn. Thank you very much for having me.
Yes. Well, I hope that you are going to blow our minds with your intellectual prowess and leave us feeling overwhelmed yet also enlightened by the end of it.
Yes. As opposed to, dozing off at the end, which I
sometimes manage. Well, the other the two topics, I've got nothing against them at all. I just thought it sounds like stuff that would be better suited for your own channel, whereas this isn't like a review of the year. I don't mind. I honestly don't mind. I mean, if you want to talk about being a Euro mutt, we can. I don't mind.
Thank you. This is a safe space for Euro mutts. No, we can. We could do that. We could do that another time. But I do feel
we can
as
talk
though
about Euro pop, Euro dance, whatever you like.
Right, Euro techno, Euro synthesis, fusion, Euro fusion restaurants. I have one thing though that I want to share with you because part of it started, you know, before we get into things like Ukraine or Gaza or whatever, which is British television shows. As you know, I've watched a few, much as I got into my deep biscuit lore. Deep dive with the help of a biscuit specialists from Blighty. And so I moved on to the television programs, thinking to myself, you know, this is really a way that I can grasp something about the people and their nature. And I found it particularly to be the case watching old shows. I mentioned this talking with Dee last night briefly. Which is that, well, you know, you presented a number of caveats when you said check out Rising Damp. You did not say that it's God's gift to the universe. You acknowledged that there are issues with it, but you thought, you know, take a look if you want to see one of these old shows. And I do really like the character of Rigsby, but with older shows, I had watched some of the Rising Damp, and I watched all of Father Ted. Because D turned me onto that. Girls, drink. So I asked for people to share with me some other shows, and I've only begun to look at them. One of them is Likely Lads, I think, is one. There's another one, and I watched a few of those. But I got another one called.
I'm not quite sure what you mean by that.
This is Rising Damp. That's Leonard Rossiter playing Rigsby. I've got a folder full of images here. Here's another one. It's set in a what's called a boarding house, which might not mean much to Americans. I don't know. It's just a house that's being rented out to various tenants, and they're all different people. There's obviously a black guy there, but the landlord is Rigsby. Different characters. I really like it. I love it, actually. It's an adorable program. And then you mentioned Father Ted. I can illustrate that. I've got some photos from
girls.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. The infamous, that, and also here's Claire Grogan. and what else? Yeah. Oh, this one is hilarious. This is a very famous moment.
Oh, yes.
So
there were some excellent ones. Excellent. And it was, yeah, I think in its own way, it was quite subversive, anti-Irish, anti-Catholic. But somehow it managed to be funny. The Rising Damp is funny despite that just insufferable black homosexual. I can't.
Well, it's not supposed to be gay, but anyway.
There's no way he speaks that way if he's not, you know. Well, I'm not so sure about that, Rigsby.
All but, right, I'll take your word for it. The actor's Don Warrington. I don't know if he's gay, but anyway, it's a moment in time. I mean, I'm going to be watching a lot of comedy, and actually just for research purposes, I don't honestly expect to find much of it very funny. Next year, I'm going to be watching, in order to write about the history of subversive TV comedy since the war, since 1945. So there'll be a lot of essays coming out throughout next year, hopefully, about this kind of thing. With Britain, TV, the 60s was really the start of this. On the race matter, Till Death Us Do Part and Curry and Chips. So I haven't actually seen either of those. So I'm going to be watching those and talking about them. But anyway, this is your time on Millennial, not mine.
Not at all. I was going to say that in terms of the history, and this is kind of what I was talking about with Dee, I began to watch Dad's Army, you know.
It's a great program. As I've often said, along with Fawlty Towers, those are the two programs that actually live up to their hype. They actually are as funny as you've heard, in my opinion. What did you think of it?
I loved it. I'm trying to learn the song. We are the boys. Yes, but so I'm getting acquainted with it. I'm most of the way through. I've gotten to the color parts now, and I love it. I love it. The show itself is obviously very, very entertaining. And much more off color in spots than, you know, I would have thought. But what's interesting about it is that it's a window into the culture. You know, you have the comedy aspect of watching the show, but it's a form of self-improvement watching it, because by understanding the comedy in any respect, you sort of get a sense of the people and of their psychology. And in this case, it's very interesting, as I was saying to Dee, because you've got people, you know, this is all in living memory. If they had tried to pull certain angles on all of this with the audiences, you know, with the asses in seats that were there at the time, it would have been, you know, immediately transparent, you know, the whole scheme. And so they were forced to conform in some respects to some of the reality of the period, even with the satire and the caricatures and the exaggeration. And so it's interesting to me because I can watch a comedy show, you know, when I'm cooking or cleaning or doing whatever, you know, where I can kind of keep an eye on it and listen to it. And at the same time, I can see, excuse me, how it was, how an earlier period was echoed and sort of iterated and carried forward in the awareness of a subsequent generation. But it also has certain things that you have to imagine were quite real from that period that were expressed, you know, like trying to get on the women in line, trying to get on the good side of the butcher in order to get, you know, more sausages based on ration stamps or whatever. And so I find it.
I always remember a line of dialogue from him when he's talking about that, and he's talking about a particular woman, and he says, "But does she really love me, or does she just want my meat?" It's kind of it's things like that. That it's off it's polite, and but also a bit saucy, a bit suggestive. But because of those limits, it can be hilarious. Whereas if you were to be more overt, it just the humor would be gone immediately.
And the range of characters that you require in order to express whatever the archetypal human situation is present with the stock that you have there. You don't have to have some supercilious, purse-lipped, nappy-headed tenant to you know, look askance at Rigsby and prove that, you know, in fact, he's a proper gentleman, or that the guy who's supposed to be a proper gentleman isn't, you know, who's stealing everyone's money. You like, for example, where the captain is moving down along the line and he's, you know, he's like, well, the fighting spirit of the English, but he happens to be standing right in front of the Scotsman, and you see him like pause uncomfortably and say, of the Britons. Or you've got the I guess Cockney sort of character who's always trying to scam and the rest. You know, there's a yes. full range of expression available in the native peoples, you know, to tell the necessary
don't
stories.
Don't get me started. You know, yeah, absolutely. And also, you've like that's the Spiv character on the left there, the far left, who you're just talking about, the Cockney.
Spiv, yes.
And he, it's weird, you know, once he, that character left, the program just wasn't the same at all. I don't know if you watched the entire thing, but I watched the entire thing from start to finish, and it just does not recover from losing that character. And, you know, the actor had died, so maybe that got the other actors down. I don't know, but one way or another, it's never as good again. But yes, I do agree about the range of archetypes that are there. In the characters, everyone in Britain, maybe not so much nowadays, but even when I was a child, everyone had known someone like every one of those characters. You knew them from real life, and so you can absolutely identify with it and understand it.
The captain character, you know, it's one of the reasons that I refer to, and it's strange. I've talked to several Brits I know in my circles, and many of them don't know about Godfrey Bloom. And every year when Godfrey Bloom comes on, I'm like, yes, the archetype, you know, it would sound as though I would want to dismiss him, because the captain character is, of course, as an archetype, you know, there's something a bit silly about him, but nevertheless, you know, he comes through and there's this whole can-do attitude, you know, we'll take care of it. Right.
And the thing is, that's Captain Mannering. And the thing is, yes, he's poked fun at, for sure, but he's never an idiot. He's never a moron. He's never degraded. And indeed, there's also an episode where it's strange, right in the middle of the program, there's an episode where he has a sort of affair. I don't think they actually sleep together, but he falls in love with a woman, and she falls in love with him. And it's very sensitively handled, because he's married, he's got a wife. And again, it's not denigrating him, even though it often pokes fun at him, at his pomposity. He's a sympathetic character that you're meant to sympathize with.
Yeah, and I think there's something, you know, what you referred to as saucy, you know, a great word, by the way, saucy. You saucy tot, brazen saucy tot. There's a way in which the things are handled. You know, there are fart jokes, but it's, you know, indirect about flatulence, you know. And then there's the sergeant, what's his name, who's got that widow on the side that he goes to see. And of course, everyone knows that they're seeing each other, you know, but he gets called the uncle, you know, and eventually, you know, circumstance conspires to make him marry the woman. So I think there's something about the show, even it's the late 60s, if I remember correctly.
It started in the late 60s to the late 70s.
And somewhere in that range, you know, they understood that they were, even though it was the 60s, they put this saucy material into it.
But you've got to remember that even though it was the late 60s, most people were not hippies. Or, you know, engaging in swinging London, or ultra liberals running, I don't know, the BBC or whatever. In fact, even the BBC wasn't run by ultra liberals at that time, because Monty Python ran into trouble. They nearly axed it because they were still quite crusty conservative types. So Britain in the late 60s was really not, I don't know, maybe America was ahead of it in that regard at the time, but it was still a largely conservative country. And the other thing is, as you said, this was only 25 years after the war. So a lot of people would, well within living memory, I mean, loads of people watching it would have been there at the time. So you couldn't afford to misrepresent it, and you couldn't afford to disrespect it. And I don't actually think that the writers wanted to either. I think they were,
they
weren't yet of the generation that really would come up 10, 15 years later in the 80s, in the start of the 80s, who would want to denigrate it.
Yeah, and that's where there's some aspects. I mean, I get it. Father Ted's funny, and people have, and it's funny. I enjoyed it. I laughed. You know, it's generally lighthearted, but it does seem, you know, with the male and female Irish character on the island that are always trying to kill each other. You know, it's that they're always abusive. They can be a little bit stupid. They're very backward.
It should be
punished by being sent to such a place.
Yeah, and it should be said that Father Ted has a very different tone. It's much more surreal. The humor is much more extreme. And, you know, Father Ted, it's with Dad's Army, it's really about characters, character dynamics and so on. With Father Ted, it's, I mean, characters are obviously key to it, but it's also about farce and surreal humor and so on.
Yeah, and with the Dad's Army, there's also the aspect, you know, we were talking about it being in living memory, but because of the nature of the subject matter, the writers would have to have known that it would be of particular interest to people of the generation that had lived through it, and they would be sitting in rooms gathered around the telly together because they were not as widely distributed. You know, I mean, this was a thing to go over to the house of the person who had the television, or for all the family to get together and sit on the furniture in front of the television together and watch it as a group. And so you can see how it was like, you know, well, Dad, was it really like that? And they're like, well, yes, it was, son.
Yeah. You know? And that's another difference with America, that I think the television wasn't as widely, there weren't as many TVs in Britain in up until, I don't know, maybe the 80s. It would still be the case that not necessarily everyone, especially poorer families, they might not all have their own TV. Whereas I think in America, it was basically a mandatory that every suburban house had a TV and a Buick.
Right. And the videos, the VHS players came in much later, because I remember watching all of the young ones in high school as it happens on VHS. And, you know, it was, have you got a video? You know, so even, you know, the VCR
I remember seeing the same thing and noting the same thing, that it was a novelty for a house to have a video player. That was in 1983 or 4, and it would have been quite unusual. I remember when we got our first VCR, it must have been in 88, and it was seen as a bit of a luxury, an unnecessary expense for us to have that. So what I was going to say about the TV was, because it wasn't as omnipresent and cheaply available, that meant that not everyone had one. So therefore, it was a much more communal experience. You'd be watching it with other people. You'd be going around to your friend's house. You'd be going to your auntie's house, whatever, and watching it as a family and so on. So it wasn't so much, you know, like every teenager had a TV in his room kind of thing. But that was much more the case, certainly in the 90s, for sure.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I remember far enough back to where, you know, in my family, when I was a little kid, watching my three sons and Andy Griffith show reruns in black and white on a little black and white television. You know, you had a small black and white TV. And then, you know, it was a big deal when there was finally a color TV. And of course, all that tech was just crazy how huge it was. You had the Zenith TVs that were in a wooden cabinet to look like a piece of furniture. I remember playing Pong on one of those. Or you had the, after you watched your videotape, you would have to like take it and put it into this, you know, the cool people who had the real gear would have the separate rewinder because it was faster. And you just plug it into the rewinder and you could, you know, rewind the material. It was very different. Oh yeah. And that's a small old one. I love the aesthetic of those things, though. The old radios like that as well, with the veneer and in some cases marquetry. They're very...
I don't have these organized chronologically, I'm afraid. So I don't even know the years for some of these. But here's a very amusing one from, I guess, the late 80s.
Mid-80s. Yeah. That's one of the back display. They actually have a unit that displays, I think the front of that, if I'm not mistaken, is a Fresnel lens. And if you find those huge old back projection televisions in dumps, you can actually pull this giant Fresnel lens out of them, which is, you know, if you're into such things, it's very cool. You can focus sunlight very precisely in order to burn holes in things but as if with a giant magnifying glass, but they're flexible and you can roll them up. Sorry, that's another bit of nerdery and autism, but I really do like the TV shows. I just wanted to touch on that because I had there are a number of them that were, there's something called Something and Horses. What were recommended to me? I just very quickly, if I
only
may, I
want to get your horses. Only Fools and Horses.
Semica, that's one, and I haven't looked at it yet. I think, what did I say? I wrote All Right Brits. That should pull it up.
It's funny you should say this, because just last night I had an American on called Anti Dem, and he was saying that he does not like, he likes a lot of British TV shows, but he just couldn't get into Only Fools and Horses. And I said, I think it's because it's quite mired in British class stuff. But it might not even be that.
But what isn't, from what I've seen of the TV shows? I mean, what isn't? I mean, there's probably a lot less of it with Father Ted. But in all the other things I've seen, I mean, it's like you can't escape the class stuff. And part of what makes it so interesting to me is you have all Americans eventually, I mean, if they have two brain cells to rub together, they arrive at this point where they're like, wow, they talk like us, but that's a different place. You know, it's not just that, you know, we have totally different meanings for Fanny. You know, it's a different fuck. It's a foreign country. And to me, it's very, very interesting because I can bring to bear all of my detailed, my ability to appreciate things linguistically and to like catch little subtleties that, I mean, my Turkish was never particularly good, but certainly not good enough to catch the little subtle things that go by linguistically. And in the case of Britain, for me, and much more so than like a place like Australia filled with fucking savages, Britain is interesting to me because it's like I have this ability because of the shared language to really penetrate into this absolutely foreign culture and see these differences. But let's see here. What did they, the young ones, I had already watched it. Dad's Army, I jumped on and, what else? Something called Still Game. The Brass Eye.
Sorry, hold on a second. Still Game, it's not my kind of thing, but a lot of people do like it. What was the one before Brass Eye?
The Day to Day, Brass Eye.
Okay, The Day to Day.
Still Game, yeah.
So The Day to Day and Brass Eye were projects of Chris Morris, and it was a satire of news coverage. British news at that time in the late 80s and throughout the 90s could be quite pompous. I guess it still is now. And that was really what he was moaning about. That's really all it was. There wasn't actually that much more to it than that. The rest of the humor was just surrealist farce stuff. I don't really know. I guess he would say that he was attacking hypocrisy. But he's another one of these liberals who have revealed their own hypocrisy once stuff like the trans issue comes up. You know, now he cut ties with Graham Linehan because Graham Linehan spoke out about the trans issue and children and all this. So it really gives the lie to the whole thing. It's like you were self-righteous about the news readers being pompous, but now you're being pompous and now you're showing yourself up. You're not interested in kindness or being open-minded, and you're also not interested in the truth either, because you're enabling the corruption of children. So fuck you, basically. I mean, that's really what I would say to Chris Morris. He's known as this genius, very intelligent guy and all that, but in the end, if this trips you up, this trips you up. You're really not that smart. Or even if you are, it doesn't matter because you've got other priorities. You're not actually wedded to the truth. I mean, there's a lot that you could say about Chris Morris. He is, I mean, he's clearly talented, and the Brass Eye is clearly, it's clever. But again, I just think this has shown up so many of them who, in the 90s especially, and in the 80s, they were so pleased with themselves, these liberal comedians and comedy writers. And they've really just come a cropper, as we say in Britain.
There's these expressions, man. That other one you used recently, and I heard it, I was like, what the fuck? It was, you said something along the lines of there is like is chalk and cheese, or it's chalk and cheese. And then I sat there thinking to myself, I'm like, wait a minute. If I put a mouthful of chalk, dry, powdery, you know, versus moist and yielding, I was like, wow, chalk and cheese. You know, there should be an attempt to chart the course of human peoples based on their metaphors and things. I was talking to Chris Gard. He's one of these fucking savages from below the equator. And you know, I was telling him about how the Appalachian people, and they have heavy, heavy English and considerable Scots kind of vibe. And they have this whole thing about, they have these expressions that just have a dry, very dry sense of humor. And it's always, always delivered with a straight face. Like the nature of delivery is never, you never say something and kind of laugh as you're saying it, ever. And all of their amusing observations have to be delivered in such a fashion that if you're not paying attention, you didn't even realize somebody just made a joke. So we have a common saying, which is, if there's something that you can only do based on experience and you can't really explain how to get it right, you just have to get the knack for it or whatever. They say you have to hold your mouth right. They'll be like, just got to hold your mouth right. And Gard was saying that they've got this Australian savage version that is something about like, hold your tongue right, or as you're working on something. And I think that chalk and cheese, or like people from Appalachia used to say, a willful waste is a woeful want. It's been real and it's been fun, but it ain't been real fun. You know, they have all these sorts of deliveries, and I feel like it should be mapped, including chalk and cheese. But I've got other ones here. People recommended Blackadder. Somebody said something about how I have to go into Blackadder from like season two. The first one isn't very good, but I've tried and it was just so slapstick that maybe I just, maybe I missed something in my genetics. There's Yes Minister.
No. We're not going to go on. You have to justify.
You're not just. You're not.
All right. What the fuck? You didn't like Blackadder.
How dare you? Well, maybe, perhaps I haven't seen. Perhaps I haven't seen enough of it yet. Mea maxima culpa.
You say that knowing that you watched every bloody episode.
No, I didn't. I really have only watched like two or three, and I was just like, what?
I can't believe it. It's commonly regarded as, Fawlty Towers, Only Fools, and Blackadder, and Dad's Army are the four best sitcoms Britain's ever produced. That's the common thinking, and I would probably have to agree. Blackadder, I can't believe it. The first season is completely very different. The second season is in Elizabethan Shakespeare sort of time. And I think it's the funniest. I think it's the best in terms of comedy. The third season is the effeminate 18th century Regency era. And then the fourth season is in the First World War, in the trenches. So, I don't know. I mean, what I will say is, it is quite Jewish. Stephen Fry's half Jewish, but identifies as a Jew. Ben Elton is half Jewish and doesn't identify as a Jew and doesn't seem to really care about it. And there was somebody else. Well, Miriam Margolyes, she shows up in it now and then.
Oh, so Stephen Fry has his origins in Blackadder as well?
Well, Yes, actually.
I don't think he was
famous until he played Lord Melchett in the second season. So, yeah.
So this predated his Jeeves and Wooster thing?
Yeah, yeah. All and right. his A Bit of Fry and Laurie as well. Lord Melchett, that was 85. So, yeah, yeah. I think that was probably his first big break. I think he'd appeared in The Young Ones here and there once or twice. Alarmingly skinny and bony. Like he was so young. But yeah, that was what I think that was what gave him his big break. So, but it was the same with, I mean, Rowan Atkinson had done Not the 9 o'clock News. Tony Robinson, I think, was unknown at that time. I can't remember who else is in it now. Tim McInerney was really not ever known for anything but Blackadder, although he does have a big acting career. So yeah, it was for how a lot of people made their names. Robbie Coltrane even was in it as well.
Well, this is the closest you've ever come to saying "How dare you, you damn Yank!" So,
oh no,
I'm going to go back. I'll try it. I'll give it a good college try.
It's fine if you don't like it. I mean, look, I used to be very much like this, where I'd be precious about things that I like. I think as you get older, you get over that, and you just accept. You know, I don't actually need people to like the things I like. Right. It's fine. So I don't care. I mean, if you don't like it, it's fine. But I'm just surprised because. I thought you would like it. It sounds
clearly, I have to get my mind right, as we say. Or as Strother Martin said in that thing with Paul Newman, Cool Hand Luke, he's like, what we have here is failure to communicate. I will get my mind right, Woes. I will. But okay, so the Only Fools and Horses you like as well?
Not as much. That's not really my kind of thing so much, but it is very, I mean, it's clearly very good. There's no doubt that there's real talent there. Certainly in the writing, the three actors are good. I just don't really it's very difficult for me to identify with them. And I don't need to do that. Obviously, I can still enjoy it. I don't know, there's just something kind of dirty about it. It's like working class Cockneys in the early 80s. I don't know. The thing is, and this is real, they simply don't exist anymore. You know, the demographic changes mean that Only Fools and Horses is now an anachronism. It's now obsolete. It's a relic. They've just all gone. Their communities, Peckham, where it's set, it's just not a white working class Cockney area anymore. And most of East London isn't, most of South London isn't. So in that sense, it's sad, you know? And so when I say that I don't identify with the guy, I don't mean anything, any sort of contempt in that statement. I'm more on their side than most people are, to be honest, you know, they're extinct now. And it's outrageous. It's absolutely terrible that this has happened, but it did happen.
Yeah. And ever more broadly. Yeah. All the different little types are disappearing. Okay. What do you make of the League of Gentlemen?
Right. I've not seen that much of it. I did. There's clearly talent there I don't think you can deny that. It's just obvious. But it's not my kind of thing. And I definitely thought, I saw some of the first season and I thought, yeah, it's quite good. And then I saw an episode from the third season and I thought, fuck's sake, this is just sick. It's so dark. It's not funny anymore. But I think the makers and the audience both sort of agreed that what we want is, yeah, go even darker. And so they did. I didn't like the result, but I wasn't that keen on it in the first place, to be honest. But that's not a condemnation. It's just, it's not my kind of thing. Now, what did you think?
What about, I've not yet seen any of it. I'm ranking these. I'm going to finish Dad's Army and then I'll either do Blackadder and then Only Fools and Horses. Again, this is like my biscuits. You know, I have to move through them. I have to properly taste them and digest them, you know. the Marks and Spencer biscuits versus the
the Sainsbury's biscuits and the McVitie's biscuits.
Yeah. Yes, McVitie's. Yes, still the goddamn man. The no chocolate hobnobs are just shockingly good. How dare you make that face? The no chocolate hobnobs are a superior fucking biscuit.
I'm a bit surprised. It's been a very long time since I partook of the no chocolate hobnobs, so I can't speak from experience. But I was never a huge fan of hobnobs. I like digestives. I wouldn't go to war with anyone about this, though.
Right. And Jammy Dodgers. What's your view on the Jammy Dodger?
Oh, I like those. Yeah, I like Jammy Dodgers.
Yeah. All right, fair enough. Well, yeah, so I've got a number of these to look at. I just thought I'd mention it because, you know, I started into the, you were the one who recommended Rising Damp before I even, you know, had Father Ted recommended to me. So now I'm going down the rabbit hole, you know.
On Telegram, I wrote a list of recommended episodes of Rising Damp. I don't know if you consulted that, but I also wrote a list of the episodes where you see special parts of the house that you never see in any other episodes.
you're very much into the sets, the set design, the original buildings. Like you got into the original locations where RoboCop was filmed. See, that's part of your memory palace. Is like you want to find out where the little rooms and nooks and unknown areas are.
Oh. Yeah.
Whereas Academic Agent has his own kind of autism, but he would do it all with a fucking Excel spreadsheet, you know, and rank it.
And clearly he's much more numerical and all into that kind of side of it. But what would he be doing? Like
he is indeed numerical. Of
how often that topic comes up in the dialogue? I will marvel over the cozy sets. For example, in Rising Damp, there's one episode where you see the garage, but you never see it in any other. There's one episode where you see the basement, but only then. So I like that. It's like a novelty, and you're gradually piecing together a map of the house in your head as you watch the program. And it's just so fucking cozy. It's adorable. And I really love that kind of stuff.
Hell yes. All right. Well, The Likely Lads is a little strange for me. It was recommended to me by
it's not my kind of thing, The Likely Lads. Loads of people really like it, but not my
Kind. I just didn't understand. Finis Omnia was saying he said set in Morgoth's part of Great Britain, and I just came in, I'm like, what the fuck? Everybody tells me, you know, Yorkshire and all this kind of stuff, and then I listen and it's not his accent. It's not his accent. And so I had a spurg out about that on Twitter, and someone else came in with these two chefs who I guess are from his region, and they did in fact sound like Morgoth. So that was at least satisfying. Like there are more of him. He's not sui generis. You know, there is a type of person that speaks as he does, and there's more than one, which was, I don't know, somehow that just sort of like set everything back on its axis again.
Did you have it in your head that Morgoth gained his accent in some freak accident?
He came through some fucking interdimensional rift at the bottom of a coal mine. I don't know. It spontaneously emerged. But it was very strange because let me find it. Because I said none of these, in response to Finis Omnia, I said none of these people actually speak like Morgoth. And then someone came in. Let me see who these guys are. They shared a clip of the Hairy Bikers, a pair of TV chefs, and that was strange to see them like carefully mixing things up. You know, you've got to mix the egg just right for the power,
the money power. It would be funny if they just started using at each other.
He's
not got strange. It's not pure Geordie, it's not pure Newcastle. His voice, his accent is
Northumberland something.
If I were more familiar with that area, I'd probably be able to tell you more precisely where exactly his accent derives from, but I can't. I can just tell you it's clearly in the Newcastle area, because it sounds like that. But yeah, you've got to realize that up until recently, the accents in Britain changed every 5 miles. It would be a slightly different accent. That's how dense it is.
Yeah, that's that whole thing from My Fair Lady, where, you know, they could pin you down, given your accent, to like one village or like at most three villages. And I guess that's gone too. You know, I remember the first time I went to Stafford, some fucking Sikh in a turban picked me up in the taxi, and I was like, shit, this isn't going to be how I thought it was going to be.
In Staffordshire?
Yeah. Yeah.
Staffordshire. Wow. The only thing I know about Staffordshire, there was an early 90s techno group from there called Alternate. That's all I know. It's literally all I know about Staffordshire.
Wow. I got good recommendations, I think, for the shows, and I will dive in them. I just wanted to check with you on that. I must do my watching now. Hopefully there's a good bit of Dad's Army left. I mean, I think I'm probably only through the first couple of seasons, so surely there are many.
As I say, it's terrific up until the Spiff character disappears. And thereafter, there are still good episodes, but it's just lost its mojo, if you like. And it gets less funny as well, because the actors are getting clearly older, like they're approaching death, some of them. I think a lot of them died in the early 80s. So, you know, they're very old at that time. These were actors who'd already had their careers on the stage, on cinema. It was weird seeing, I watched a clip from Ben Hur, and God, I've forgotten hold on a minute. John Le Mesurier was in it, and he plays Sergeant Wilson in Dad's Army, but he's about, you know, 40 years, or well, yeah, 30 years younger, and that was very strange. But yeah, they were all classically trained actors. This is all a big thing here, that we talk about classically trained actors. And how their comedy timing was perfect. It was really good. They were very good at doing this. I'm not quite clear on what the difference is between classically training an actor and the alternative. I know that there are different schools of acting that are all over the
right. World. Grotowski towards a poor theater. Exactly. Method acting. Yeah.
All of that. And then there's the one that starts with S, like Stanislavski or something. But anyway, in Britain, for decades and decades, they talk, it was classical training. And one way or another, it was training them for the stage, really. And that was what it was designed for. So you had to speak clearly, properly, certain accent, RP, received pronunciation. But not just that. It wasn't just the accent. It was the whole pacing. And you know, nowadays it does seem quite artificial. It seems quite stilted. But, you know, I think realism is greatly overrated. Also with everything, sets, special effects. We're accustomed to too much realism.
The only thing possibly more depressing and unwelcome than realism is reality. But that's probably just our current circumstances. You know, it's a fucking mess. But yeah, the TV shows are, they're very cool. I'm confirmed constantly in my belief that Britain is a fucking foreign country, absolutely a foreign country. Like it's almost inexplicable to me. You know, the best I can do is find these types. Like there are things about the Irish that I understand that go with our Southern thing. You know, we have this joke, you know, you probably heard it. There are several versions. One is, you know, they all come across basically as punchlines for the joke. You know, what's the famous last words of every redneck? It'll be like, hold my beer, or bet you I can, or, hey fellers, watch this, you know? So there's, I grew up around, Irish and English descent country people when they were still, country people, you know? And so there's some of that, that I can recognize, but the English and D is communicated to me that I have no understanding whatsoever of, of the British upper class and this whole Norman vibe that I still just, I don't understand. A strange cunning cruelty and reservation, you know, in public, and then in private, God knows what goes on, you know, but, yeah, it's a strange world. Likewise, I mean, how the fuck am I supposed to understand a Scot or a border reaver like Morgoth? You know, it seems like the best fun ever to get drunk with somebody like Morgoth, unless they all decide to beat you to death, you know?
The thing is, what you just said there, how are you meant to understand them? The trouble is, how are we even meant to understand ourselves now? Because we're not honestly represented on TV nowadays, you know, sitcoms and dramas. No longer show us as we actually are in any real way. So that retards our ability to keep...
right, the feedback mechanism
of
the production of the media. It's been cut, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you could say, well, you never needed TV in the past in order to perpetuate your local culture. Trouble is, the local culture has been completely replaced with the TV and the internet.
And Turkish barber shops.
So this is why young British people now sound increasingly American, literally, their accents. I can hear it. There's clearly an American twang in really anyone younger than 35, or even anyone younger than 40. There's a certain influence there that is unmistakable. And especially now with teenagers, because they're all watching YouTube. That's what they watch. So, or TikTok or whatever. So it's a global culture now. And so that again retards the local. I think this is all very bad. I really do. And I don't know. There's nothing that can... The only thing that would stop this is pulling the plug on the internet, and reversing mass immigration. I mean, it's otherwise all gone. I mean, all of these ancestral accents and cultures and the local dialects, everything, it will all be lost. And I don't know what to say. It's just a depressing thing.
Yeah, I reckon if you go out into the country, you know, you can still find the little oases that persist. But it's crazy to imagine how long they did persist in their own way, insulated across a distance of a mile between the two towns. And now it's just, it's gone. I was joking when I was talking with Dee and some others, you know, on his cocktail hour, which I recommend. There's a type of boot that I discovered in the rural part of Alabama that I'm in. I've now seen it on three different men, and, you know, and now I know that this is a boot that's like favored by the people here. This like sort of half cowboy boot, half engineer's boot that's always well worn, and that, you know, can do sort of guys who come and work on your well house will be wearing it. You know, they're little details. Or I talk regularly to my friend who's in East Tennessee.
I'm just imagining you, like, and the camera closes in on you, zooms in fast because you've noticed the boot. And then that happens three times, and then you're piecing it together in your head that it's obviously a thing in this area.
This is the boot, but that's my nature. That's why, you know, people, I'll put on a little bit of the twang when I'm talking to them, but I won't overdo it because there's only a certain amount of it I can do and not be inauthentic. You know, there's a little bit more of speaking this way that I can do when I'm relaxed, but then you'll discover that they have their own sharp differences. When I talk to my friend up in, East Tennessee, she's like, yeah, I stopped by at this intersection and there's this girl standing there. And, you know, we talked for a bit and I gave her a ride and it became clear, you know, she's from around here, you know, how she talked. And then I get down here and there's this Alabama accent that's a little bit different. It's like a little bit more like you got something in your mouth while you're talking. Like we still have those divisions. Or like, you know, Virginia or North Carolina, where they'll be like, well, no, I'm not sure about that. It's not the kind of thing that I'd want to get involved in. You know, this sort of more lilty, high class, a little bit more of an affectation. That's all disappearing too, except out in these little country areas where you can still spot the vestiges. There is a boot. And I found it. They all look at me. I mean, this happened to me once in a strip club when I came back from Turkey for a visit. And this friend of mine, who was always kind of degenerate, he's like, let's go to a strip club together. And since I grew up as a punk rocker hanging out in strip clubs, I'm like, fine, I'll go. And I had been, you know, off in Turkey for a couple of years. And when I went into this strip club, you know, my hair was growing out. So it was at that awkward length, a little bit shorter than yours, to where you just can't control anything. And so I had this ball cap on. I walked into the strip club, and the enormous looming bouncer, the only place where you have bouncers in the U.S. who are as big as some of the ones you see outside of British pubs or did back in the day, was the strip clubs. You know, they will invest in the largest piece of meat possible to ensure that you just don't even want to try, to keep it all calm, you know. And they told me I had to take my hat off. And I remember I was sitting by the show bar. I'm like, man, you do not want to put me on gynecology row. And my friend was like, well, let's sit here. The show bar is where the woman will walk along the bar that you're drinking on, in her little outfits with her tea back and the rest. And I was never my thing. And I remember this woman stopped, and she's holding the brass rail above her, you know, in her little outfit. And she looks down at me, and I've been forced to take my ball cap off. So my hair is like fucking, you know, all over the place. I look like a total freak. And she looked down at me and she said, you're not from here, are you? And that's something I get quite a bit in life, because I don't fit in wherever I go. So yeah, even out here in the country, what the hell is wrong with you, boy?
But is this where you originally came from?
Well, yes, the South, but my people are from all over it, and I moved around. And my mother, God damn it, man, I hate this, but she. And I have a friend from Tupelo, Mississippi, who did the same thing. I sneer at both of them. Even my dear mother, I'm like, you ate your accent, you swallowed it, you hid it where you're from. Like, I still hate that. So I grew up with my father. Both my parents were from Louisiana, but they traveled widely. And my father grew up for a time in Central America. So they both had this like sort of consciously constructed level accent. I picked up a little bit to where, you know, I caught myself once saying Japan instead of Japan, you know, and so it can come across. I can do it, and it's not totally fake. And if I drink a bit, it'll come out. But I don't have it. Like, and also, see, I was in the cities.
How can you say this kind of thing and then not understand class in Britain?
But it's not quite, yes, there is that, absolutely. And it's a parallel. And to your point, which is right on the money, associated with how you speak, you know, which they talk about again in that great movie, My Fair Lady. But otherwise, there is so much, like, there's so much social mobility, as a matter of course, that really it just comes down to whether or not you can speak with precision and with grammatical correctness, and you know, it's here, and you can use it as a weapon, but less so. In the old days, you know, you could like settle into your speech. You know, you're at the dry cleaners and somebody screwed your shit up, and you're like, "Would you please go back and look a second time? I'd really appreciate that. Thank you." And everyone would get kind of like, you know, wow, this is a white man speaking politely. You know, I better be careful. But now, like, the tea has disappeared, and they're like, no, you didn't. You know, or the girls will be like, thank you. They don't say thank you. They say some shit like, thank you. It's turned into this horrible. Yeah, it's just another thing that's fucking gone.
But that's something that I noticed in young Americans. I won't name names, but there was a YouTuber. I think, I don't actually know whether he's Canadian or American. But he, I noticed, dropped T's. And I was very, it was strange the first time I heard this. And then I realized that his girlfriend also did it, or had started doing it. But I don't know, presumably because he did it. And it seems to be becoming a thing. Like, you'll hear young Americans saying this kind of thing. I can't think of an example now. But like what we call in Britain the glossal stop. Where they'll say the bottle instead of the bottle.
Right, like that didn't. Means, no, he didn't.
Well, that's dropping a D. I mean, that's even more extreme.
But they do, because it requires, there's this too much of this thing of a precision. Also, you have these different ethnic groups, and then they're bringing in their second generation, you know, that's been raised here, but you'll just hear Guatemala or Mexico sort of like cast as a pall over how they speak. Just these vestiges that all kind of smear together as they reach some accommodation with each other, where they all sort of drop to the lowest shared level, you know, the lowest common denominator. And yeah, so it disappears as well. And it takes some attention to how you speak. You know, this is it's probably more of a middle class thing, but I think, you know, not to cast aspersions, but I think you and I probably both share it. You know, attention with how you write, attention to grammar, attention to how you speak. And I catch shit about it all the time, but I was recently trying to talk about it. Fucking grammar Nazi. They'll call you a grammar Nazi. And I'm like, you fucking dirtbags. Like, think about it for a minute.
Yeah, or you should call them grammar Jews.
Well, that actually is the point. The point I was heading towards, because you've got it's an established fact that everyone knows and can see, which is that leftist subversion proceeds through language, and it proceeds through just sick and arbitrary impositions, usually lexical impositions, you know, use this term rather than this other term. But we've seen them dig deeper to attack pronouns, which are an even stranger, more deeply embedded unit of language. And so fucking with them creates even greater degrees of ambiguity, right? You know, my pronouns are, and now you're like, holy shit. You know, every time I hear them talk about they and them, I'm like, they do talk about, you know, my name is Legion. I'm going to speak of myself in the plural. You know, I expect like a cloud of flies to come out of their mouth as they speak, if their pronouns are they and them, you know. But leftist subversion proceeds through language, and it proceeds through the erosion of standards, be they lexical or grammatical or what have you. And so somebody says grammar Nazi, and I did a little bit of research into it. A few people on Twitter responded that there are variants of that that appear in other languages across the West.
Here's an amazing meme that I've just put up. I don't know if you can see that. Mm-hmm. Another one.
It's also that's anti-cat, by the way. But
well,
the,
not necessarily. It might be pro-cat.
Indeed, damn grammar Jews.
It's like grammar, doesn't it?
right. Grammar Jews should be dressed in a striped suit. But the point is that they come after us for how we speak and for a concern with how you speak and how you write. And they do it by calling you a Nazi. And I'm like, otherwise quite sensible people who have their head screwed on correctly will be like, oh no, we should say morph. There's nothing wrong with saying morph and impactful, you know, like impactful. Shut the fuck up, man.
But this is the thing. See, I am a grammar Nazi and I do believe in standards and so forth, but sorry, I am, but I don't mind the word impactful. Or I mean, that is an ugly word. Impactful is
fucking
ugly.
Judas.
It is ugly. But to use it in the verb, is that could impact us quite badly and so on. I don't really mind that.
Until you dig into it. It can be used, but it's an odd variant that gets set aside because it carries with it the connotations, the sense of something having struck like a fucking asteroid or a missile. You know, what is the impact? What will the impact be? But see, as soon as you start to consider it and be honest about it, you realize that it just appeared because a pack of shitbirds can't keep straight in their mind the difference between affect and effect. And so they settled upon impact. Well, what will the impact be? Will it impact me? How were you impacted? And effect and affect are fucking gone. They've disappeared from the language. They have. Yeah,
that's true. Now that you say it.
We must fight this.
True. Yes, I agree. You're quite correct. I hadn't noticed this, but you're absolutely
my
right.
God. Yeah, you know, fucking morph. Ugh.
I don't know if there's any. Well, morph, yeah, it just means change, evolve. It morphs into, between, from one state to another.
I don't know. It doesn't. It comes from morph. Morph means structure or shape, which is why in biology you can say a morph. It's a unit of structure. Or you can say morpheme in language, the smallest unit within a word that still carries a meaning of its own, like pre or post, right? It means form or shape. And so I'm like, okay, if you just want to be stupid and use this sort of Tarzan speak, you could say, well, it formed into something, or it shaped into something. If you want to say it properly, you would say transform, transmutate, or metamorphose, right? We've got morph. My argument is that it really came, well, the Brits will argue that it comes from that fucking character morph, right? But that still means a shape that you can change. Yeah, but it really comes from the cinemorph filter in the days of the Amiga, where you took two-dimensional images and caused them to transition.
Like in Michael Jackson's Black or White video. But this was all from The Abyss originally, and Willow, the film Willow, also used it.
Mad Madigan! Little boys running.
Mad Madigan! Or was it? I can't remember. They used it in Willow for one shot, I think. Then it was in Michael Jackson's Black or White video, 91. Then it was obviously in T2. It must have been behind the basis of the dinosaur stuff in Jurassic Park. It must have been.
Well, somewhere. Yes, but those were 3D. The original morph was a transition between the two-dimensional images, and it became a fundamental theme of all the 3D stuff. And I was there when, you know, I had my Amiga 500, and then, you know, everybody was into 3D, and, you know, wow, I've got the, oh, check out, I'm waiting for it to ray trace. And that was the period where, you know, everyone was doing 3D stuff. They were, oh, I do the modeling, or I do the animation, or they were a graphic designer, but who was also a DJ at night. And so there was this whole thing to bring in these other terms that would show that you were a part of this group of cool kids. And now this wretched little vestige, this lexical polyp, you know, this when hangs off of us, this morph. And I hear otherwise respectable people say it, and they should be ashamed of themselves.
I'll remember that. I've got to say that this stream is a perfect example of how a stream can so easily go off course if you don't maintain discipline at the start. Because we were going to talk about the year, 2023, but we've now spent an hour talking about biscuits, British sitcoms, and now grammar and accents. Yes.
Linguistic degeneration.
Nothing about 2023 whatsoever, and that's my fault, and I do apologize to anyone who was expecting a report of the year. Would you still like to venture into that territory, Samuel Gogg?
Yeah, I think there's stuff briefly I can mention about it. I mean, one of the big subjects is Ukraine. And I have not yet had an opportunity to see all of your guests. I caught the Old Glory Club stream live and John D live because they're friends. I caught Godfrey Bloom almost immediately after the fact, just because he's always a favorite. I caught Jared Taylor, you know, but there's still a huge number of people I still want to watch. So I guess what I would just ask you first, is there any way to kind of sum up what a few of the hot takes before I share what, you know, my take on it is, or would it be better to just jump into it?
Well, I think what I should first do is put up this comment that someone just posted.
It hurts me. You realize that this is,
and consider that your punishment for straying off course so early on.
It stretches my ring.
Even though it was my fault. Okay.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, it must
all
be.
All right. So,
did you hear anything in particular that was like a very kind of a cool take on it, or a controversial one what's up with Ukraine?
I think the big thing about it all is that it seems to be a change in the climate of geopolitics and America's standing in the world because of its support of Ukraine, which is kind of waning now, and also because of Gaza and because of Afghanistan before that. So that would seem to be where we a logical starting point. What would you say about America's morale geopolitically, being the world policeman?
It's a wreck. I mean, it's a total wreck. I mean, I was just talking with Prudentialist over on a stream of his where we were discussing whatever this stupid what is it called? Enduring prosperity. Let me just see here. It's called Prosperity Guardian. Sorry. Operation Prosperity Guardian is where we're supposedly going to lead an international coalition of the willing in the area of the Red Sea and the Bab el Mandeb and the Gulf of Aden in order to stop these Houthi attacks on ships. And it's a shit show. It's falling apart, and it's not even really going to work properly in the first place because there are limits to naval power. And what we have going on with the United States, and I brought it up in that stream, as others did, indeed, not just me. I think Prude mentioned it first. You've got this basic idea that the job of the United States actually is to be the world's policeman. And, you know, with free trade and, you know, all this kind of stuff, the ideas, and we took it in turn from the Brits, whose Navy, you know, in its own time made the world safe for democracy, you know, extinguished slavery. And whether you like it or not, if you are doing business globally, you could certainly see the usefulness of having a different tax base, the American people, cover the cost of making your shipping be safe. And I mean, indeed, that's my view on what really happened with the transition from the British East India Company to the Raj. A bunch of people in India said, "Fuck this! Why do we have to have our shareholders foot the bill for this? Let's turn it over to the British Crown. Let's call it the Raj, and we can screw the British taxpayers to keep all of this secure." So that's supposed to be our job, and we at this point can't even manage that. So I think why do you think that is?
Why can't America manage to be the world's policeman anymore?
Well, part of it is that you have to maintain a certain image so that there is a price to be paid that can be recognized by anyone who's contemplating doing anything out of order for doing so. And now we're seeing that that's not the case. And you've also got the risk of the bullshit that we're getting up to. You know, it does begin to bring in greater and greater risks the further it goes. And you know, a regional war that involves Iran is something a lot of Europeans don't want. And at the same time, remember, it was supposed to be this whole idea of a North Atlantic Treaty Organization, a kind of alliance, the idea that the United States pays for the security of Europe, the taxpayer foots that bill. Yes, you lose your sovereignty to a certain extent, but it saves you a lot of money. You know, but it doesn't matter how much money is saved for Germany if, as a result of our scheming, they lose their access to inexpensive energy and they undergo a process of swift and incredibly destructive process of deindustrialization. If everybody's getting a brisk fucking as a result of what we're trying to pitch as being our helpful, you know, input.
I see. That's the thing. The AFD or, well, not necessarily them, but any nationalist party, any vaguely nationalist party that got hold of, that got power in Germany, would have a big decision to make about whether it's worth staying under America's protection if this is what it means, that you can't have, you can't have industry, you can't have cheap energy. I mean, maybe it's better to strike out on your own. But of course, the consequences of that, I mean, it would be a huge decision to make because the consequences could be dire for Germany.
And the consequences currently are dire for Germany. Or look at what's happening with Austria that has enjoyed a considerable amount of freedom in the face of the massive pressures east and west that could be applied to it as a country. You know, they adopted a position of neutrality. And that is being increasingly eroded. And you see them more and more being forced to take positions in one direction or another that are not going to help them. I mean, if you want to look at the most grisly example, look at what's happening to Ukraine itself, you know, with all the assistance we're providing them. I understand.
Which enabled them to decimate their young male population.
Yeah, which is, if they recover from it at all, and I mean that, it's going to take generations, if it's even possible. And territorially, it looks like they're going to be carved up. Now, there are people that I not only respect, but like, who take a very different view on Ukraine than I do. And my sense is the most notable of them that I have in mind. It's because his friends are fighting. And to me, that seems like about the best and most solid take you could have. Like, well, why are you for them? But because it's my friends, and fuck you, you know. I get that, I understand it, but my take is a bit different. So, with all respect to people who have a different view, the whole thing with Ukraine has clearly been put. It's been in planning for quite some time. If you know anybody who's interested, can go look at my highly speculative streams on Prometheanism. There are three of them. I did them with Prudentialist and Charlemagne, and Martin Zellner came in on the third of them, which was very interesting. Very happy to have him as a guest. Looking at Prometheanism as a strategy, I guess what I'm trying to give you my basic geopolitical take on what's going on with Ukraine. If you look at the Three Seas Initiative, and this is all highly speculative, of course, your mileage may vary. You don't have to accept what I'm saying. This is just my speculative take. The Three Seas Initiative, the Intermarium, all of this is, you know, like the Visegrad Group. This is all about, in my view, putting an insulation layer between Russia and countries in Europe, either in, certainly in the Eastern European countries that are included in that bloc. They become a place where the U.S. puts in a great deal of investment by moving their bases to Poland, by inflaming nationalism-based Poland. They agitate nationalism as it suits them in Eastern European countries, and they thereby carve off countries from Russia's sphere of influence. But they place this barrier between Russia and countries that are further west. And so to me, that seems like the long game. It's just a different version of the old business of keeping America in, Germany down, and Russia out. And so when I look at that, I imagine, how could this possibly help Ukraine? You know, and it also, there's an additional dimension, highly speculative, but it is my view. Speculation, my personal opinion, it is my understanding. I'm just going to assert it that way so it's clear and no one can come after me. It's my view that Biden is entirely compromised, and that it's heavily in regard to Ukraine, but further back in the background, there is a very competent Chinese hand. Now, this is not to say that there are not other groups involved in Ukraine. I want to make that very clear. This is not an Alex Jones take saying that, well, it's really the Chi-Coms who control Hollywood. But I believe that Biden has been pushed, whether he's fully aware of it or his handlers are fully aware of it or not. They've been encouraged to do precisely the thing that pushes Russia out of Europe, that pushes Russia entirely into the arms of China, and that forces Russia, for its own security, to undertake to secure energy supplies to China, which is critical for China because our naval interdiction could otherwise cut them off from energy sources. And prior to this whole business in Ukraine, Russia and China kept a certain amount of distance because they're two hegemons within the same Eurasian landmass that you would otherwise expect to be engaged in fierce competition. And indeed, they have been in the past. So we've essentially pushed China and Russia together in a way that absolutely benefits China. And we've also made absolute fools of ourselves. We've possibly destroyed NATO. We'll have to see. And we've utterly wrecked whatever scraps of our reputation used to remain in Europe. And so if you really look at it and say, cui bono, China benefits. And then you take a look at what's happened now with Iran. You know, Iran has been pushed into Russia's arms, and Russia is now assisting Iran more because they need assistance there. And so what you have is Iran, and for people who pay attention, you would have seen previously that Russia kept a certain amount of distance from Iran because it didn't want to screw with its relationships further west. Now it said, to hell with this. The whole thing has been torpedoed. It's in our interest to back Iran. And now Iran, China, and Russia are in a position to work well together. So my take is that this is ultimately a very cunning Chinese play that destroys the reputation of the United States, embarrasses it deeply, implicates it in one of the most horrific scenes of destruction that we've seen in my lifetime, which is Ukraine itself. I see it as something that could have been avoided, but Biden rushed into it.
Well, it seems like it wasn't so much rushing into it as it was the program in place since at least 2014.
Yes, but there's a way in which once they rolled with it, they've just thrown everything sort of unthinkingly into it, imagining that they would have to emerge from it victorious. And so in that respect, I mean, sort of heedlessly and recklessly accelerating in this later phase. But yes, you're quite right. And I tried to make that point at the outset. You know, this has arguably been going on since, you know, all that shit with Gorbachev and Bush and the idea that NATO would not expand eastward at all.
Would you like to see a boomer meme regarding Biden?
Yes.
Just to change the tone slightly.
Yeah.
That's pretty bad, isn't it? Sorry, to get back to serious matters.
I would have liked to have seen it, though, with the Zelensky, who is, in some respect, he might be the most repulsive human being I've ever seen. As soon as he speaks, awful. There are these weird horripilations. My hair stands on end. He's, well, we must... Yeah.
Yeah, he's gross.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen in Ukraine. I do believe that, as I guessed at the outset, you know, I am the eater of crow, and I will keep that designation up on my Twitter profile until Biden's out of office as my just penance. But I hold with my prediction from the outset that Russia is going to come out of this in the best position to claim victory, even if it's not, you know, entirely there, you know, on balance. Out of the parties involved, Russia is going to be able to claim victory most convincingly. And I believe it's going to accelerate, you know, the situation there to such a degree that people aren't going to be able to pretend that it's not happening. However, there are people who say, you know, Ukraine has already lost. Yes, I think in the long term they have, and that we've hit a turning point, but that does not mean that they are going to just suddenly begin to fold on the battlefields. There are now, I mean, Russia's got an offensive going on right now, but they're a little bit wiser about it. So they didn't proclaim it, which means they can back out with plausible deniability if it doesn't work, which the Ukrainians now cannot do with their approach. And they are making advances. We'll have to see if they really are as large and quick as they appear to be just over this last week. They've actually taken back all the territory and more that the Ukrainian offensive recently gained around Bakhmut. And they're also gaining ground. They're going after a Novomikhailovka or whatever it's called. And, you know, there's some other areas where they're moving quite quickly and up by the, whatever that forest is called in the Liman area. They are moving quickly. So it could be that they fall back. But then again, it seems that they've got NATO command more directly involved now. And it seems like it's not that they're folding. It's more that they're pulling back to positions that will allow them to build better defensive lines. So I guess my point is that the Ukrainians, for whatever anybody wants to say about it, they fight hard. They fight very hard and they do not fold. So I think they have lost, but I don't think you're going to see anytime soon a sudden rout. Though I may be wrong, I wish they'd just find some way to settle it, because it's ridiculous that once again we just see, you know, white people slaughtering each other.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be a long, slow defeat where many of them, many of them are just going to be killed. But I just don't think they can win. And I don't say that with any pleasure. I've got no particular love for Russia or the Kremlin or Putin, and I never have done. But it's always been this way to me. So I don't know. I just think it's terrible. The whole thing is awful. And you're going to be left with a decimated population and displaced population. The women and kids are going to be in other countries. And what they'll do, the solution that will be recommended for Ukraine will be mass immigration of Africans into Ukraine. I mean, that's the solution for everything nowadays. So, I mean, it's awful. I don't know, there's no nice way or funny way to... there's nothing you can say about this. It's just a fucking terrible situation that should never have come about. But I think as long as a corrupt and morally bankrupt America is in charge, this kind of thing is going to happen. And when I say America, I don't mean the American people, just to be absolutely clear.
Well, not all of them anyway. Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. So there's that. And then Gaza. That's the other big thing from this year. And I think it's kind of falling. I mean, I don't know. I've not been watching the news cycle so much because I've been busy for the last few weeks. But it seems to me that it's kind of falling out of the news cycle slightly. But at the start of, you know, middle of October, it was obviously huge. And it went through different phases. At first, the media were right behind Israel. The politicians remained right behind Israel, in Britain as well, I mean, throughout the whole thing, and they still are. But the media is now, even, and again, this might be specific to Britain, because American media is much more Jewish than British media. But it seems like there's a lot of criticism of Israel, and especially Netanyahu himself, personally, for his decisions and his attitude. And just Zionism in general as a project, because everyone can see what it requires, what it necessitates, realistically, is mass killing, ethnic cleansing.
Yeah, expulsion, yep.
Yeah. So this is a whole thing, very complicated, because the left are dead against this kind of thing. The right are, well, the center-right, the neocons love this sort of thing.
Our greatest ally, yeah.
Yeah. But then you've got...
A country that's always refused to sign any formal agreement of alliance with us, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, and refuses to admit that it has nuclear weapons and all of that. Yeah, and we don't even need to mention the USS Liberty. It's obviously a terrible relationship there. But anyway, the point is that this is all, it seems to be that Israel has really disgraced itself, made itself look absolutely awful in the minds of lefties everywhere. I guess normal people everywhere are broadly on the side of the Palestinians, insofar as they just don't like the idea of people getting slaughtered by a powerful entity. The neocons seem to be the only ones who are on Israel's side here. But then the politicians in Britain as well as America have to support Israel because, well, for reasons that best known to themselves, I guess. We can all guess at them. So what do you think the long-term repercussions of this are going to be? Basically, do you think that Israel as a country is now, and again, I'm not talking about ordinary Israelis, I'm talking about the power establishment in that country, the government. Do you think that that is now going to be less of a, do you think it's going to have less international prestige than it had 6 months ago, let's say?
Yeah, I think they're confronting real problems. But I am not fully able to get my head around exactly what's happening there. I did a stream recently with a couple of Israelis in order to try to get a sense of what's going on there with factions, because I've been tracking what's going on vis-a-vis the United States and Israel for a while now. And people who pay attention to such things will remember that when Obama was in office, he did not get along with Israel at all. There was famously a time when he went to Israel to visit and he was left like out on the tarmac without any proper delegation, or not delegation, but welcome committee there for him to greet him as he came off the plane, which was a very serious snub. And of course, Obama liked to talk about his putative Muslim background. And, you know, when he first came into office, he traveled to the Middle East and, you know, it was all about how we're going to get together with the Muslim world. And oddly enough, that was right about the time that everything happened with the Arab Spring. So Obama comes into office. He's a black president. He can do no wrong. I mean, he's basically ab initio as he hatches out of his black egg. He gets given a Nobel Prize for peace, you know, out of nowhere. And then the entire Muslim world goes up in flames as a result of things that we now in retrospect know were manipulations by three-letter agencies. You know, all the Facebook games with the Arab Spring in Egypt, absolutely shattering and smashing Syria to split it along all kinds of ethnic and sectarian lines. Algeria had its problems. Libya was absolutely destroyed. And Egypt was in serious turmoil for quite some time, and other places besides. And so it seems to me that there was a plan to smash things up in the Middle East and to remake certain things. And so I'm not, and it all started when Obama came into office, but I'm not entirely sure that somebody like Obama wasn't chosen as a kind of cover for that. And I'm of the opinion that the tension between Obama and Netanyahu was real. And so you now, to bring it all back around, you've now got Biden, who's from that crew. He's basically just a front, a cat's paw for the exact same people, Clinton and Obama and the rest. And, you know, your Victoria Nulands and your Blinkens and the rest. And these people have a tension with Israel. I was tracking East Mediterranean natural gas. And there was a huge development of it in the East Med in the Trump years. And it was earlier as well, but there was a lot of tension. Turkey was coming down and rattling sabers saying, no, you're not going to be able to like come up with some pipeline that runs from Israel and Egyptian gas fields to Cyprus and then over to Crete or from Egypt over to Crete and then to Greece and then Europe. No, we're not going to have that. But the Israelis were trying to do it. And if you were to arrange something where Israel had its own native energy production that was at such a scale that they had a surplus that they could sell, that little country would be in a very different position because it would have a huge influx of cash and lower energy costs that would enable it, for example, to do what Germany did industrially with the access to cheap energy. And they would have the income and the ability to turn knobs on and off to whatever limited extent. They were never going to be able to put enough gas into Europe to cover even, I don't know, 20% of its demands, but it would matter. And it would give them a kind of leverage and a kind of income that would free them to a considerable extent from U.S. influence. Everybody likes to talk about the influence of the Israelis and globalist Jews and the media complex and the rest. And it's there upon the U.S. But there is also, if you talk to any Israelis, they'll talk to you about it. And I don't think they're lying. I think it's quite real. They chafe under the constant constraints that in many respects are placed upon them, in Israel at least, by the U.S. And because the U.S., you know, he who pays the piper calls the tune, they maintain that control. So Biden comes into office, and what's the first thing he does? He shuts down that whole thing of East Mediterranean natural gas going to Europe. Now, think about that. That's a little weird, given that we now know they must have been planning at the time to separate Europe from Russia, which would mean that energy concerns are paramount. I believe the whole JPCOA or JCPOA, I can't remember what it, the deal to bring Iran back online, you know, with nuclear inspections and everything that we saw unfold under Obama, that was all designed to bring Iran back into the community of nations, as it were, because that's another source of energy that could run into Europe as an alternative to Russia. But Netanyahu is very against that, and possibly the most pro-Jewish Israeli administration we've had in quite some time, Trump, was fully with Israel and saying, hell no, we're not letting Iran back in. So Biden comes back in and says, well, no, we're not going to have any of this development of oil and natural gas coming from Israel. And they're trying to quietly, like, do some things with Iran to make it happen. Okay. And now you have all this tension between the, I believe, between the Biden administration and Netanyahu. And in support of that, in addition to the business of the previous tension with Obama, in addition to shutting down the natural gas projects, you've got the business of color revolutions, total like National Endowment for Democracy, Maidan, color revolution type shit on the streets in Israel, and people coming out in their tens of thousands to protest what Netanyahu was trying to do, which was to regain control over the Supreme Court of Israel, or whatever it's technically called, but it's basically a Supreme Court. And we know how those Supreme Courts work. We know that we had legislation from the bench and have for quite some time in the United States. We know that Tony Blair came in and set up an equivalent institution in Britain, which is totally fucking alien, in order to ensure that they have this last line of defense. And in the case of Israel, Netanyahu was trying to get rid of that. And then you see, you know, the Rainbow Dildo Brigade in the streets in their thousands, and they're trying to take Netanyahu down along with the court cases. So I do not think that the Biden administration is really on Israel's side. I think they have certain areas of geopolitics in terms of the relationship between the United States and Israel that they have to cleave to, that they can't, you know, color outside the lines with. So they have to send, you know, 1,000-pound bombs and, you know, plenty of artillery shells and everything else. But I think they want Netanyahu gone. I think they want him gone yesterday. And so I think we see a thing having to do with factions in Israel, which brings me back to my thing about talking to those two Israelis, trying to understand what's going on there. I think there is a strong move on the part of the sort of globalist Jews to push that program forward in Israel. And then you've got a shifted faction that used to be maybe Ashkenazi elite security service military types. And many of them have been pulled over to the other side to at least appear to want to go with the globalist take, or they're just so sick of Netanyahu that you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, which has forced Netanyahu over into a coalition with increasingly like non-Ashkenazi and increasingly religious nationalist groups. And so there's a war between globalism and nationalism that is unfolding in Israel at this time. And it has very interesting implications for the future of Zionism that you mentioned, you know, when you framed the question. But I cannot yet figure it out. I do think, though, that there is, ever since Obama, there has been a desire to get the fuck rid of Netanyahu, to bring Iran online, and they failed. And now Iran is fully over in the Russian-Chinese camp. So that's done. And you also have to remember that there's an enormous number of Jews who emigrated to Israel from Russia, which raises the question of Russian influence in that country. And of course, well, there's,
you know, let's not get into that, because that just complicates it even more. It's an unbelievable number of different strands and different forces interacting here. I guess there's the thing about weakening nationalism within Israel, which means that Israel would then join Global Homo. You know, I know it's already there to some extent. I mean, certainly lots of the LGBT stuff going on there.
And gay pride in Tel Aviv.
Yeah, exactly. Tel Aviv is some sort of gay mecca in some way. And it's got consumerism. But I guess this would mean transforming it really into just another country, just another outlet of Global Homo. In which case, its conflict with the Palestinians, with Gaza and all that, would start to just be meaningless. Because what really does it matter? We're all consumers. We're all part of Global Homo. Netanyahu, in that sense, seems like a ruthless, well, nationalist. Not just nationalist, an ethno-supremacist. And I think that does not jive well with certainly the Obama administration and now with the Biden administration. Because
look at the alt-right talking point where they used to say, is there a problem with ethno-nationalism? We'll take it up with Israel. You know, that has to weigh on their minds.
Exactly. It's a blatant open contradiction, but it's one that might actually bother them on a deep level, not just because it's bad PR and, we're being hypocrites. It might actually be so ingrained in them to desire mixing that they really don't like Israel. They really don't like it being an ethno state or on the way to becoming an ethno state. You know, the Ashkenazi are the ones who have all the power there and all that. So it might be that it really actually does annoy, disturb them. In which case they want it. I don't know. You see, this is a very difficult thing to grasp, because liberal diaspora Jews, it's extremely difficult to characterize all of this, because some of them marry out, some of them don't. Some of them are very, and even when they do marry out, they're still ethno-supremacist in a way. And then some of them are Zionist, some of them are anti-Zionist. They want Jewish strongholds, but not in Israel. And some of them just have no interest and want everyone to mix, including themselves. So it's a very difficult thing to characterize. But what does seem to be quite consistent is that they have little interest in other people's nationalism anywhere, because they don't want other groups to be powerful against
them. Didn't Barbara Spector just appear again after a long hiatus with something that underscores
that? Yeah, but she celebrates Israeli nationalism, though. So she's, right, I think, of a certain generation. I think we're really talking about younger ones who aren't. I mean, she's clearly pro-Israel. I don't know if she would describe herself as a Zionist, but she's talking about how wonderful it is, in that clip, how wonderful it is to see Jewish culture.
Growing of the roots in that soil.
Yeah. All of that. Yeah, exactly.
Blood and soil.
Blood and soil. Literally blood and soil nationalism there, from the woman who is so famously said that Europe is not going to be the it's not going to be the big mono ethnic societies that it was in the past. It's going to be multicultural. It's learning how to be multiculturalism, and Jews are going to be resented because of their leading role in that transformation. But without that transformation, Europe will not survive. But she's perfectly confident that Israel will survive as a Jewish stronghold. So I think she's of a certain generation. I think younger Jews probably have less attachment. And again, I'm obviously speaking in extremely broad strokes here, that they probably have less attachment to Israel than that generation. I think a lot of them have drunk the Kool-Aid that they've given to everyone else, which is that, it's kind of gross, it's icky for a group of people to remain
a group of people.
Yeah, exactly. It's inbreeding. It's incest and so forth. So, in which case, Israel is going to be embarrassing to them, not just because of its military activities, but also just for its very character as a Jewish state.
I think there's. Yeah, I think there's some of that going on, but like you, I cannot put my finger on it. I think there's definitely something going on with the myth of shared vision and purpose as regards to the Jews. I don't think that's there. I've seen, you know, how a secular Jew will despise a religious one, you know, an Orthodox one. I've seen likewise how the Orthodox ones will despise a secular one. And there have certainly been all sorts of manipulations from the Jewish elite that did not turn out well for just an what they would call an everyday Jewish person, you know, or whatever. And I've certainly known enough left-wing Jews or, you know, known them or encountered them in my life. Jewish women working in porn, you know, Jewish women who are Jewish men who marry a black woman. You know, I mean, I've seen all kinds of things among the globalist leftist Jews where they have.
We're all very happy to see that kind of mixing going on. Tremendous.
Diversity is not just our strength, but theirs. So, you know, I don't think that there is this sort of, monolithic purpose in that thing that we call a community, because it has its own factions and dividing lines, and I don't understand them properly. So I don't know what the size and shape of the gambit is here. I'm not entirely clear on it, except that I do think that they're making a move now for a kind of ethnic cleansing. I mean, it seems incontrovertible. I mean, it seems obvious that this is a form of ethnic cleansing. I mean, the best you could say is that it's like the most massive instance of them mowing the grass that we've yet seen. But, you know, if they push those people off of the coastline, then you've got a situation where all of the natural gas and energy that lies off that strip of coast gets added to the energy that's available there. There's also a considerable amount of that off the coast of Lebanon. And there are now, as it stands now, disputes about some of those gas fields that, you know, maybe it should roll over to Lebanon, maybe it should roll over to Egypt. So taking the coastline in that area amounts to taking control of large and, if not recently discovered, at least recently announced reserves of energy. And I think it's important to look back at what happened with Syria. They wanted to take that country off the map and carve it up as they saw fit. And right at that point, that's when Russia said, niet. And they came down and, you know, you've got Latakia and Tarsus and air base and naval base, one of the only ones that Russia currently has still abroad. And they said, not just no, but hell no. Because there's more of these, you know, coastal energy reserves. And as long as that area stays locked up with these conflicts, none of that can come online. And now we're in a weird position where I don't see where it would really suit Russia in general terms to allow all of that to come online. And by backing Syria, they kept their position there and they ensured that they have a seat at the table if anyone does want to develop that energy. Likewise, though, for the United States, everybody forgets that under President Trump, the United States was the biggest net exporter of energy in the world. We were keeping our own gas prices low and we were selling shitloads of it to everyone. And then Biden came in and shut that down. But likewise, why would the U.S. want to have all those new forms of energy coming online when we just cut the umbilicus between Germany and Russia? Remember, a lot of that gas, as you know, flowed to other countries thereafter. When we couldn't, in theory, sell high-priced LNG carried in tankers, you know, across the sea, and continue to keep Germany down, but to our benefit. So it's so complex in there that I cannot figure out what the hell is going on. But I will say that I'm sure that the idea that the United States is just strictly backing Israel is a bit preposterous. I think we've seen clear signs that they, at a minimum that I can imagine, is they want to get rid of Netanyahu. They understand that in order to do so, they have to talk about Israelis doing bad things. Now, if they want to get rid of him, they got to talk about him doing bad things. And so this has to be introduced into the discourse, which may have to do with why we're beginning to see more of that coming out through the media, not just in the in Britain, but also in the U.S. And then there's one last piece, which I think everybody should bear in mind. It only occurred to me recently when I was doing some research. I didn't realize in World War I, there were enormous numbers of Jews who were fighting for the Germans. Huge numbers. And remember, Germany was allied with the Ottomans. And who had control of the Holy Land at that time? The Ottomans. And so German-speaking countries are where Zionism primarily comes from. And so you've got groups of well-to-do German Jews prior to the mid-century Germans who have all kinds of roles in the military and strongly support the Kaiser and have enlisted in the war. And they're fighting against the Brits and the rest. And presumably they've been promised something in return. You know, my one Israeli guy I know is like, yes, my family's an old one. We used to say ekmek for bread, which is the Turkish word for bread. And that's how he would brag about how early they were there. So Zionists were moving there when it was in control of the Ottomans. And then you've got this thing where Britain is fucked. If they don't get the United States to come into the war, it's very likely they're going to lose. And so what happens? This is just my take. This is speculative. People who understand history better can come in and correct me. But my take at present is that the British establishment said, well, shit, we need to get America online. But we've got a lot of very wealthy Jews, some of whom are very important in the Wilson administration. And even at this early point, there are a lot of Jews who control important media outlets, not to the extent that they do today, but back then it was still significant. And we want to bring the U.S. in. How are we going to overcome all this pacifism? We've sent our spies, people like Aleister Crowley was sent to the United States to work for the British government to get us dragged into the war, particularly with the Lusitania. People like, you know, later they sent people like Roald Dahl. The number of British spies sent to the U.S. to get us to do shit is staggering. But they just couldn't get it to happen. So how do you get the U.S. Jews online? You have to imagine to yourself, well, maybe they're stopping it because they still think the best bet is for Germany to come out ahead and then sort of, you know, do some nice things for us in return for our support and for keeping the U.S. out. So what happens? Arthur Balfour comes along and works out the Balfour Declaration. He's this statesman, I understand, from Apostolic Majesty. He was on the wane. He wasn't as important anymore. But they do this big public declaration. And then a short time thereafter, almost immediately thereafter, and the negotiation for that declaration started much earlier. Suddenly the U.S. says, well, hell yeah, let's do it. And all the American Jews come on board and say, yeah, let's do it. You know, the Brits have explicitly promised us concessions there and a homeland of our own. Well, then what happens? You know, the Brits win. You've got the Palestinian mandate and everything. But the Jews are all pissed off. They're like, you promised us. And I love this because it's a joke about perfidious Albion. The Jews are like, we cut a deal with you. We're supposed to get a holy land. But the Brits are saying, well, no, we've got oil there and we've got, you know, the Palestinians to think about. Maybe we, you know, we should all live together. And the Jews are like, fuck you. We made a deal. And the Brits are like, well, we can't really do it that way. And so what do you get? You get terrorist organizations blowing up the King David Hotel and, you know, the early leaders of Israel that were originally terrorists fighting against the British. So then you get World War II comes along. What's interesting is the Nazis apparently understood that some shit had gone wrong because they alienated the Jews. So you see Hitler literally trying to arrive at some kind of accommodation with the Zionists in, according to my view, presumably to tamp down the possibility of this kind of problem again. They cut the Havre Agreement, which is, you know, they minted those little medals that you've probably seen that have the Star of David on one side and the swastika on the other. And I'm not saying it was a great deal for the Jews, but it was a great deal for the Zionists because the Hitler administration, you know, the regime or whatever, would the Reich would basically say, yeah, you get the fuck out of here. But look, we'll cut you a deal where we at least give you something for all your property. That will be sent over. So all that money is accumulated and interest is earned on it, and control of it for a time is in the hands of the Zionists, who will carry your money, distribute it to you when you become an emigre that's gone there. So it works out for the Zionists. It works out for Hitler. But then the apparently what happened is the American Jewry, and probably British Jewry too, and you know, Jewish financial power and media power says, no, we've got to rip Germany up root and branch. And what does the United States basically do? The U.S. becomes the new guarantor for Israel, and an even better one that's even more committed than even Britain was. But now look at it from a Jewish perspective. Once again, they're like, oy vey, you know, we cut a fucking deal. Where is our homeland? I've got this weird shit with fucking Palestinians everywhere. Gewalt, you know, fuck. So from an Israeli point of view,
you're an Alabama Jew there.
Sorry, Dan, I can't even do the accent. But, you know, there is a perspective, you know, an Israeli one that I think is legitimate so far as it goes, that they thought they cut a deal. They've done this twice now. And they're never allowed to push the people out and get a functioning state of their own that doesn't have constant balkanization levers built into it that other people can pull. And so I think, to wrap that up, I think what's going on here is there's something about that, where there's a certain side of the powers that be in Israel that are like, you know what, fuck this. And I think that's part of the game with the energy too, which is if we get our own industrial base, if we get our own technological base, and we get our own inexpensive energy, and we settle once and for all this diversity that's supposed to be our strength, but it's actually keeping us down and fucking us, then we will properly be able to emerge. Maybe it's in the context of a greater Israel, who knows, right? But they'll finally be able to get their nation on a firm footing. And in a weird way, I do think that the Brits and the Americans screwed the Israelis, at least in the basic terms of their deal. And we have ever since used this whole thing. We're like, we'll support you. We'll give you money. We'll give you whatever you need. We'll stand back while you mow the grass and stuff. But you can't actually just remove those people. You can't actually remove those people. Then your country would be on a firm basis to where we couldn't create and inflame problems constantly.
All right, I was looking for the Eternal Anglo meme, but I... here it is, yes. Right. Yeah, I don't think I'm going to put that up on screen. All right. This has been fascinating, but I am flaking out now.
Yeah, and you've got to be a wreck, dude. This is your fourth one.
Yeah, and it's the sheer complexity of... I mean, I didn't quite realize the breadth of the canvas when I asked you the question.
Yes, so, sorry, dude. Sorry. I told you before we started that I am a master of droning on, and you were like politely, oh, no, you see, I have my power. I have my skill.
You did. I underestimated your powers. we could have just kept talking about biscuits, but I thought that's not quite substantial enough for a millennial audience. So I asked you about the geopolitics. So thank you. We've done that, and it has been very interesting. Lots of comments there. Oh, there are super chats. So I'll ask you those ones, and then we can wrap up. All right. Hail the Grand Morph Semiogog. That's Dino being rather sarcastic. I'm sorry about that.
Berman.
Privileged Shitlord says Idris Elba is slated to play Captain Mannering in the remake of Dad's Army. I think he's joking. I googled it. I couldn't find any indication of this. But let's hope not. The Geezer says David Croft and Jimmy Perry wrote Dad's Army. Perry was in the Home Guard before he joined the Royal Artillery and served in Burma. Croft also served in the Royal Artillery and served in North Africa. They also wrote the programs Allo Allo, It Ain't a Half Hot Mum, You Rang My Lord, and Hide a High. So that's quite a
the lore is deep.
Yeah, Aloha Aloha is one you should definitely see, by the way. It's hilarious.
It's really, a series or a one-off?
It's a series. It was later. The golden age for British sitcoms was the 70s. I think Aloha Aloha was more... Well, it was definitely throughout the 80s. And it's actually a takeoff, a sort of piss take of a late 70s drama called Secret Army, which I haven't seen. I've got the box set, but I've never watched it. But it, in turn, was influenced by a program called Manhunt, which I love. It's my favorite TV drama. So that's the irrelevant.
And Manhunt is British as well.
Oh, yes, yes. It's all of these.
Yeah. Wow, a British show called Manhunt. Wow.
Yeah, from 1969 to 70, and it's fabulous. But I've only watched
it quickly. Tell me again, it's Manhunt, and what was the other one that you said just before that?
Oh, well, Manhunt is not a comedy, and neither is Secret
Army. Right, Secret Army.
Secret Army. Manhunt, you can get the first, it's two seasons. I think you can get the first one in America, in Region 1. But anyway, it's tremendous, but definitely an acquired taste. You have to be accustomed to that style of drama. All right. So that's, and I think the point that he was making there was that the writers of Dad's Army were writing about something that they themselves had experienced. So they weren't, you know, dickish media studies graduates writing about, you know, with their heads full of left-wing politics. It was actually their own stuff. So they wouldn't mock it and disrespect it. And indeed, there's one episode of Dad's Army where they're preparing for a German siege of the village. And it's completely serious. You know, they say something like, they know that it's highly likely that they're going to get killed. And they're just completely, okay, we're going to do it. Everyone's going to do his duty. It's very businesslike, because such was the depth of their feeling of duty. So no one was going to abandon. No one's going to run away to save himself.
And where?
It's not. That's true. But it's not done as a joke, and they're definitely not denigrating these men. What they were doing was funny with Dad's Army. You know, a bunch of old men preparing to possibly do military combat and so on. It's funny, but it's not made fun of in the sense of it was actually a real thing. It was serious. And in this program, as I say, when it becomes a real thing, they think they're about to have to do combat. It's serious. So I think that's an important thing. Anyway, Stephen says, tell Semiogog to try Tunnock's tea cakes, Tunnock's wafers, and McCoy's salt and malt vinegar crisps. Those are potato chips. Tunnock's tea cakes are pure... he uses a phrase that I think he means that he really likes them. If this guy thinks a hobnob is amazing, a Tunnock's tea cake will blow his head. There we go. Obviously, right. An ardent fan of Tunnock's tea cakes there. I like them as well, actually. They are quite a lot of fun. Darby, very much enjoying this institution we know as Millennial. Thank you very much. Shout out to Semiogog for the excellent geopolitics streams this year. There you go.
Well, very good. And it looks like, I thought you were saying tonics, like tonics water, but it's Tunnock's.
No, Tunnock's.
Tunnock's tea cakes. They've got them, but it looks like they all have chocolate.
Yes. Chocolate, biscuit, and marshmallow. Of a liquidy sort of kind.
No. Marshmallows.
Come on. Marshmallows. Are you anti-marshmallow?
Yes, I'm absolutely. They're vulgar. Ugh.
Well, I'm sorry. It's a guilty pleasure of mine. I am a closet marshmallow fancier. All right. And then there's someone else I dealt with that. Okay, have a look in here. And there are a few. Let's see. Oh, yes. Great stream. Oh, this is from Ben. Great stream so far, Woz. I've been thoroughly enjoying them. Have a great Christmas and all the best to you and yours. Well, thank you very much, Ben. So that's it. That's all of the Super Chats. So thank you very much, everyone. Folk Call says, I have a pack of tunics to hand, having one right now.
Well, I'll order a package. I will, because they're available, so I'll do it.
Do it. Yes. As I say, it's quite an unusual confection, but it's very nice. Some people swear by them. Okay, all right, Semiogog, this has been very nice. I'm sorry that I'm quite tired.
Not at all.
But yeah, we've had an interesting conversation, very much a conversation of two halves, with the first one cultural trivia, and then the second one hardcore geopolitics. It would make more sense to have done it the other way around, perhaps, but for some reason...
Two great tastes that taste great together, right? Because life is chalk and cheese.
Yes, yes. All right. This has been great. I will be back tomorrow night with... Let me see. It's the final night of the regular schedule tomorrow. So it will be David Scott, formerly of UK Column, then Frode Midyard, and then Pox Populi, and then I'll be doing the Christmas card stream. So a unique stream that we piloted last year, and it worked very well. So that's it. And then Millennial will enter the secondary phase, where it's more staggered. Okay, well, Semiogog, thank you for doing this. I know it's been quite an effort for you as well, holding all of this in your head. So I hope you've all enjoyed it at home. And someone's saying, great stream, have a great day. Excellent stream, Semiogog. Very good. And someone says, glory to the Morph Mallow. All right, we'll leave it at that. Okay, Semiogog, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
My pleasure, sir. Thanks very much. And I'll definitely be catching Frody live tomorrow night. I'll look forward to that one.
Okay. And everyone else, I will see you later.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Find the info at millennial.com/crypto. And make your donation. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.